our podcast this week, coming down from a Comic-Con high is so much easier when you've been granted an audience with the great Stan Lee, True Believers. Also, the brilliant Kumail Nanjiani talks about The Big Sick. All that and more on the Movie Podcast. We
did not re-record this intro at short notice in a snatch meeting room on Friday afternoon for reasons I will never fully disclose. And now back to the regularly scheduled intro.
Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. If you listened to our Comic-Con special episode, I can tell you that I am back and I got some sleep. Not a lot of sleep, but enough. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning, both of whom assure me that they aren't those shape-shifting menaces, the Skrulls, but there's only one way to find out is with a test of lethal cunning. You say you're the geek queen, Helen O'Hara, but how many times have Sam and Dean taken off their shirts in Supernatural?
Like practically none.
That is incorrect. You are a Skrull. I demand my £5 back. The answer is in every episode.
It is not in every episode.
They lather.
Believe me, I've
they
been
lather
watching.
Each other in every episode. All right, here's one. John Nugent, you are the quiet poddle.
Yes.
Of the podcast. But how many people's careers have you destroyed in a rage?
Well, one, John Favreau.
John Favreau, that is correct. You are John Nugent. Helen is not. Helen is a Skrull.
What?
You are John Nugent. You have destroyed John Favreau's career. He had a retreat in shame after you destroyed his career.
Yeah.
And he's directing something about a book. I don't even
something
read
about a lion?
A lion, I don't even know what it is.
Only 1 billion, mate. Forget about it. Just the one.
Just the one. Welcome both. How are you all?
Good, right, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, good.
Recovering from Comic-Con envy, obviously.
Believe me, there was no envy.
Aww.
There was no envy to be had.
Aww.
Genuinely, no envy to be had. I saw the floor once. I saw Hall H once. If you want, that, Helen? Do you want that?
Sure.
Well, you can't have it. Right, so moving on to this week's question. It comes from email. It comes from Owen Lynch. It says, hello, gang. That's nice. Long-time listener, first-time questioner. When watching John Wick for the fourth time, I noticed he wore his watch upside down to protect it while he goes on the rampage. My question is, have you ever adopted a similar life hack from a movie that you watched? Presumably not when you're going on a rampage.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, was it Owen, was it?
Owen, yeah.
Does he go on rampages a lot? Is this why he turns
his
watch?
Sounds Irish, so I'd say yes.
Some Irish rampages.
Oh my God, self-hating racism. That's appalling.
It's totally true. You never go on a rampage on the weekend?
No, you're not going on a rampage.
Oh, come on now.
Oh, wow. Okay, he's a self-hating racist. Yeah. You're just racist.
That's pretty good, though. That's a pretty good accent. Yeah. Thanks. Do it again.
Sure, will you not go on a rampage?
Ah, you lost it.
Yeah, no.
You
terrible.
Lost it, mate. Yeah. Ridiculous. At the weekend when you were bored and the snooker club was closed.
Snooker.
All small.
I look like a snooker player.
All small Northern Irish towns, the snooker clubs, Helen. This is the law. Did you not just go on a cheeky rampage? Just down the street with your mates?
Oh, we would sometimes drive along the street, that is true.
You would drive along the street, yeah. Now we're getting to the
playing
bottom of it.
Ocean Colour Scene, which could be described
ocean
as a rampage.
Ocean Colour Scene?
It was the 90s, we were very
holy
young.
Holy shit. That's amazing. Ocean Colour Scene.
Actually, it was mostly the Beastie Boys, but it was sometimes Ocean Colour
Scene.
Oh,
you're desperately
that's
grasping
the one,
for some
that's
street
the one
cred
that
there.
I remember.
Was it Ocean Colour Scene we played, or was it the Beastie Boys? Now I think about it, I think it was the Beastie Boys. No. It was Ocean Colour Scene.
Cool and then FM. A lot of salt and pepper.
But anyway, so you're not going on a rampage, all right? But you are. You want a life hack from a movie, okay? Uh-huh. You want something that has made your life easier and you saw someone do it in a movie first. What is that life hack?
I'll be honest, I'm finding it hard to think of it. I mean, I don't pick up a lot from movies. I learned how to chop an onion better from Ina Garten on the Food Network, but that's a different thing, isn't it?
How do you do that?
And so you kind of don't quite cut the end off. And then cut almost to the end and sort of chop inwards as well. So like you're chopping in two dimensions and then boom, 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 and you've got diced onions. Look, honestly, you have to see it. It doesn't work if somebody just tries to describe it.
Chop the end off. All right. What about
chop the end off.
Don't chop the end
no.
off.
No.
I just missed that completely. Mm. I heard it was end.
You don't,
and I was trying desperately to
make
hold it
rude.
Together. Yeah.
Okay.
What about the tip from Goodfellas about slicing garlic?
Yeah,
slicing
with a razor.
Garlic, so thin. We slice with a razor, so it dissolves straight into the sauce.
I mean, I don't do that because if you just chop it small, it dissolves anyway. It needs a razor.
Yeah. Oh, I one life hack I got from movies is I used to do this all the time. I'm really embarrassed. I used to rub other men's rhubarbs all the time. All really? The time. I couldn't resist.
And what and film did you pick?
I saw Batman, right? And then the Joker, he goes, never rub another man's rhubarb. And boy, was my face red.
Oh my goodness.
So I stopped doing that.
Yeah, you learned not to.
I learned not to do that.
Wow.
Yeah. Huh. So that's not. Do you ever do what Michael Corleone does in Godfather and have you pick a restaurant ahead of time? I do this all the time again. You have a restaurant picked ahead of time and you have a gun taped to the cistern.
Taped in the, well, of course.
Just in case.
How else are you going to get your gun into the restaurant? Like,
precisely, right? You're going to have someone, you know, if you fancy a quick cheeky rampage.
Sure.
Bit of a cheeky Nando's followed by a cheeky rampage. You go to the Nando's, you case it out. Maybe you have someone else leave the gun there earlier on just in case.
Always thinking.
Plausible deniability, Helen.
So important.
It's important that you don't say these things out loud on a podcast that people will listen to as well.
Right.
Plausible deniability. That's what I'm all about. Just get the gun taped to the cistern. If the peri-peri chips aren't your liking, just go apeshit with the gun. Just wave it around. It's not a real gun, obviously. It's made of carrots.
Anyway,
Empire does not condone violence.
No, it don't.
And literally nothing that Chris just said is a good idea.
It's not true. But I do have a life hack, genuine life hack that I have used. I saw once in a movie. I may even have said this in a podcast.
Is it going to be cutting off your arm and attaching a chainsaw to it?
That's a really good life hack, isn't it? That is pretty damn good. I've never started the car. I've never hot-wired a car. I've never done that.
No, neither have I.
I've never hacked into a ATM. I've never done that. Either Eddie Furlong in Terminator 2.
I feel like you're protesting a little too much now, but go ahead.
All right, so what I did and what I do is if I go to a public toilet and I have to go number two.
Oh, good Lord.
All right.
Ooh, I'm enjoying the story.
I take the toilet paper and I place it on the seat as a barrier between my buttocks and the...
That's ridiculous, and I really wish you hadn't said it. I think it's ridiculous on many, many levels.
And I got this life hack from The Mask.
Yeah.
Jim Carrey, Stanley Ipkiss, he goes to prison and he's in one of those open cells with the toilet in the middle of the cell, and he's a bit
dainty. That's meant to be a joke though, right? It's not meant to be like a recommendation. It's meant to be a punchline in itself.
It's an amazing thing. You see him, he's kind of, he doesn't want to use the toilet, but he has to use the toilet, and so he puts the toilet paper around.
Yeah, but then you just make a mess of the whole toilet for everyone who follows after you.
No, you don't, because the toilet paper goes into the toilet when the flushes.
Well, one would hope, but I've seen too many toilets messed up by that.
This is tried and trusted, Helen. This is, believe me.
It is gross and weirder than sitting on a public toilet.
Listen, if I could start a business teaching other men how to go to public toilets, I would be a bloody millionaire. I'd be flush with cash. In fact, I may even be what I call it. Because other men, quite frankly, are pigs and animals and disgusting. And I don't really want to get into it on a respectable podcast, or indeed this one. So, but yeah, they're animals, and I am not an animal because I use the toilet roll hack. As I wondered if this is something that Jim Carrey does in real life. I want because that's something that speaks of real life.
It's a joke. It's a bad. It's not advice that you're meant to take.
I think he's a germaphobe, and I think maybe he's done that in real life.
Oh.
And he's not dead. So it's done well. John.
Okay, just moving on from pooing.
Like, thank God.
The film Sideways, Alexander Payne's Sideways.
Uh-huh.
I don't know anything about wine.
But you don't drink any fucking Merlot now.
Exactly. Genuinely, this is a thing. I have no knowledge whatsoever about wine, but if I'm in a supermarket and I'm trying to select a bottle of wine, I will automatically not go for Merlot. I don't know why. I don't know what's wrong with Merlot, but...
You're talking to two teetotalers here, so we can't say... You're probably missing out, but you are probably missing out on some kind of Merlot.
He really hated Merlot. I don't know why.
He's not necessarily a character who's meant to be a role model. I'm worried that the two of you are taking bad advice. Like, I feel like Ina Garten and cooking, I can take her advice and be pretty sure that it's okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you two with the wine and with the toilet, I feel like you're taking advice from dubious sources.
I don't think so.
The Godfather, Chris.
I would trust...
I'm not sure that's good advice.
I would trust Michael Corleone with my life. And there's no evidence to suggest that would be a bad decision. Paul Giamatti is a stand-up guy. But Merlot, I imagine, has a lovely fruity tang. I would imagine raisins. Probably some raisins in there and some chocolate. some lovely chocolate as well. Lovely, you know, chocolatey tang. But the toilet thing, I think, is perfect. Another life hack, I get this from the X-Men movies, is that when I'm approaching a supermarket door, I like to use my powers of magnetism to open it.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. Wow. I thought it was your powers of telekinesis.
Well, sometimes I like to do that as well, but you know, I use the force in that case.
Right,
okay. So either I use the force or I use my powers of magnetism. So just see how it's going.
You have the force and magnetism.
We're a pretty special
and
guy,
never,
John.
Never used it until you saw the films X-Men.
I didn't know.
You had no idea.
I didn't know. It was an awakening. It really was. It's amazing. The feeling of power when you wave your fingers at a door and the door responds.
Amazing.
You can't bottle that.
I don't tip in restaurants. Because I watched Reservoir Dogs.
Yep. That's fair enough. It's not a life hack.
Is that a life hack?
I mean, that's just terrible.
Less.
That's just you being a terrible human being, yeah. I don't know. Life
hacks
are something
that you tip. That was a joke.
Life hacks are something that you do on a sort of almost everyday basis or a weekly basis that actually do help your life. And I think I've delivered one. Helen,
I've been useless.
You've been shoddy in this question. Yeah. And John, you've been kind of embarrassing, really, to be honest. I'm embarrassed to be on this podcast with you. Anyway, if you want to have your question read out in the Empire Podcast, you can do so via a number of methods. You can tweet us where we're at Empire Magazine. You can use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or chances are we won't see it. You can Facebook us as well where we're Empire Magazine. And you can email us podcast@empireonline.com, as Owen Lynch did before he went on a cheeky rampage with his watch pointed in the other direction so it didn't get smashed. Very clever. Very clever indeed. Right. So we should have a guest.
We got
two guests this week. I was pretty happy with this. This was the last thing I did at Comic-Con 2017. I'm pretty happy is an understatement. If anyone saw the pictures of me grinning at this man on Instagram, would know. But so the very last thing I did at Comic-Con 2017 was I was invited to the suite of Stan Lee. It was a Werther's original. It was just sitting there. Hotel suite of Stan Lee. And for an audience with the great man, he was 94 years old this year. And last week, in fact, he had been given the honour of having his handprints set in concrete outside the Grauman's Chinese Theatre, courtesy of his company, Legion M, which organises fan entertainment. And check out their website for more information. They were nice enough to organise this audience with the great man, which we chatted about a great many things. Comic-Con, of course. Punctuation. Why does Spider-Man have a hyphen? At long last, the man who created Spider-Man will tell us that, I think. And tons of other stuff as well. So do enjoy this. Oh, and I will say, very special guest, Gate Crashes this about 6 minutes in. It's Michael Rooker out of Guardians of the Galaxy. Enjoy.
We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the great, the legendary Stan Lee. How are you, sir?
Very well, and nice of you to inquire.
Oh, I'm a nice guy, of course. So, you know, we're a Comic-Con, Stan, and, you know, without you, there probably wouldn't even be a Comic-Con.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. The Comic-Con is really a product of all the work that everybody does in the comic book business, and now it's much more than comic books. Now you have actors, directors. It's become so big. It's a pop culture thing more than just comics.
Absolutely.
But of course, comics are at the head of pop culture.
Yes,
Don't ever forget it.
Of course. Of course. But your legacy is everywhere. I want to know what it's like being Stan Lee at Comic-Con. I imagine you haven't had to buy a drink here for about 30 years more?
To tell you the truth, I'm not a drinker.
Okay, okay.
So if anybody bought me a drink, I wouldn't be drinking it anyhow. And people are very cheap at Comic-Con. So, oh, here's Stan. He doesn't need a drink. Forget it. What was the question, by the way?
The question is, what's it like being you at Comic-Con?
I'll show you why people like to interview me and why I'm such a good interview person.
Yeah, yeah.
It's nice.
It's not bad,
now,
is it?
Actually, it's a little bit difficult because as I walk through, everybody who sees me is saying, "Hiya, Stan."
Yeah.
And I don't have a good memory. And those people saying, "Hiya, Stan," I don't know if they're just people I'm passing by or if they're people I know and I should be saying, "Hi, Joe," or "Sam," or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's a hell of a strain. I handle it beautifully. Luckily, I can handle these crises, but it isn't easy.
Do you like to shake hands? I remember my very first Comic-Con was 2003, and I met you in a corridor, and I took a picture with you. So you like to stay with the fans. You like to have your picture taken with the fans. You're very accommodating.
I love being with the fans and shaking hands and saying hello. And, of course, my hand gets very tired after a while. They ought to allow you to shake with your left hand also. In fact, that may be a custom I may start.
Okay.
That gives your right hand a little rest.
We can try it at the end of this interview. I'll try my left hand.
Speaking of customs, there is a very important thing I'd like to mention to your viewers worldwide. Most people who write comic book, the word comic book, write it as two words.
Yes.
Don't ever let them do that again. Because when you write comic book as two words, it means a comic book, a funny book.
Uh-huh.
That's not what comic books necessarily are.
Yeah.
It should always be written as one word.
Interesting.
That makes it a thing, a comic book.
Yeah.
Sets it apart from everything else.
Okay.
But calling it a comic book as two words, that's like saying it's a science fiction book or it's a love story, it's a comic book. No, it's a comic book, one word, and
one
you
word.
See to it. I will check on you later and all your listeners and make sure that they're doing it right.
We will change it. We will update our house style.
Attaboy.
From this point on.
So this book. Interview hasn't been a total waste.
No, it hasn't. It's been great. And actually, I want to ask you, Stan, because as a long-standing fan of punctuation and grammar, I'm a pedant, Spider-Man has a hyphen.
Oh, of course.
Now, is that important to you?
Yeah, very.
It's important to me.
Very
important to me.
Without the hyphen, Spider-Man wouldn't even be able to swing from building to building. That hyphen means so much. He checks. Spider-Man checks the comics himself. Is my name spelled right? And I can relate to that. If anybody wrote Stan Lee and left out an E, I'd be upset.
Yeah.
Well, imagine how Spider-Man would feel without the hyphen. I tremble to think of it.
Furious.
Yeah.
But was it important to you to have the hyphen? Because it could have been just one word. It could have been just Spider-Man.
That wouldn't have been right.
Yeah.
I wanted to play up the word spider by putting the hyphen there.
Mm-hmm.
The kids get the spider by itself, and then they see that he's a man. But if it was all together, hey, there's Spider-Man, you know, there's Batman, it would be like nothing.
Yeah, you could probably even pronounce it Spiderman.
You notice where I threw in that little dig at Batman.
Who? Never heard of him. Never heard of him.
You're my kind of reviewer.
Thank you, man. Thank you. It's been a big week for you, Stan. You had, on Tuesday, you had your handprint at the Chinese theater.
It took me a half hour to wash my hands and get that off me. That was terrible.
What was that experience like for you?
Again, I'm going to show you why I'm such a good individual.
Was it nice?
It felt good. It was good. No, I don't know what those things mean, really. I mean, so there I am with my handprint on the sidewalk where someone can step all over me. I think maybe that's what they do to people they don't like. Hey, let me put your print here on the sidewalk. Come on, everybody, walk on them, step on them.
People try and put their hands in your handprint.
Yeah, you never
that's
know.
That's going to happen. That's going to happen. That ceremony was in association with Legion M, a company I know you're associated with. Can you tell us about Legion M? What's exciting about them?
Well, it's a great company because it's really owned and run by the fans.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the first companies of its type that I know of where the fans have a say-so in what you do, what you don't do, and any company where the fans have a lot to say will either be great or it'll be more great. So I think it's terrific. And of course, I'm glad to be a part of it.
Yourself?
Really not true. He talks about Michael.
Oh, my word.
Who is that?
Oh, my word.
I heard a voice, a dreaded voice that I've been avoiding for years.
Gate crashed.
Oh, look who it is.
Gate crashed by Michael Rooker.
Michael. Michael, do I butt into your interview? Well, you never have an nobody cares about you. You never give an interview.
Nobody ever butts in.
Come on, you want to share my interview with me? Come on over.
Oh, of course not.
You went, of course not. Here he comes.
Michael, I've got loads of questions for Stan. Shall I just ask them to you?
I'll answer for Stan. Go ahead.
Okay, great.
The next two questions I answer for Stan.
All right, great.
See if I do good.
Okay.
I've been studying you. I've been studying you.
No, you'll be terrible. But it'll make these people realize the difference between you and me.
Okay, let's
go make a fool of yourself.
Go ahead. What's your question?
I'll ask a question. You answer it, and then Stan, you show him how it's done. Okay?
Good idea.
Okay, here we go. So, what's your favorite MCU cameo that you've done, Stan?
Excelsior!
Would you mind going back to the couch? Wait, stay here.
All right,
because you don't know this.
I don't know the real
Every
answer.
Bit of knowledge you can glean is useful to you. You can always say you said it. My favorite cameo, and I know everybody is waiting with bated breath, is the one I did in the Thor movie, where he's having a very potent drink, and I'm standing next to Thor, and I say, "Hey, let me have some of that." And he says, "No, you can't drink that. It's too strong for you."
Yeah.
And "No, I can handle it." So he gives me a drink, and in the next scene, they're carrying me out.
Yeah.
Now, you're saying to yourself, why is that his favorite cameo? It's no big deal. And now I'm going to answer that question. It's my favorite cameo. You probably didn't think of this. You wouldn't have thought of it.
I would never. I don't
never think of it. Because it's my only cameo that had two scenes. First me with Thor with the drink, and then being carried out. Now, I hope that'll give the various directors and producers the idea that Stan is more than a one-scene kind of guy.
Indeed.
You know, pretty soon I could run through the whole movie.
And you know, those sleeping-type scenes are really difficult to do. I did one in Guardians Volume 2. The problem is, do you snore?
No, how do I know if I snore? I don't wake up and listen to myself.
People told me that I snored. I didn't believe them.
No, you snore even when you're awake.
This is true.
I mean, what they mean is you have this terrible way of talking, your terrible personality. It always sounds like you're snoring. Why couldn't you invite somebody who speaks beautifully? Get a beautiful girl over here.
I can't control this man. He's a force of nature.
Oh, you guys are awesome.
But Michael, you said Excelsior.
Yeah, I did say Excelsior.
And that's what San says.
But he says
cameo.
Excelsior.
He said, yeah.
I said Excelsior.
You said, yeah, this is true.
Excelsior.
Oh, no, you do say Excelsior.
You gotta say it correctly.
Okay, let me do it. Go ahead, ready? Excelsior!
But don't do it better than me.
No.
I don't like it. He's getting too close.
Excelsior.
You're getting good.
I'm not as good as you.
The whole world, I gotta get a new word. The whole world is learning Excelsior.
Should we just get one from the group? There's a whole lot of people watching.
Okay.
Excelsior!
Hey, you got a good bunch here.
It's not bad. It's not bad. We should do this more often with a group watching.
I love you guys.
Do you want the second?
You destroy the interview, then you leave.
Then I leave. That's what I do.
Amazing.
Still talking?
We're still talking, just for a few more minutes. So one of the questions I was going to ask Michael to answer for you was about the creation of all these amazing heroes and characters that you made in the 1960s, obviously with the likes of Jack and Steve. There's a lot of great alliteration.
Oh, yeah, I'm a big alliteration kind of guy.
Yeah. So where do these names come from for you, Stan? I mean, you know, Reed Richards, Peter Parker, Bruce Banner.
The reason I did it, frankly, I have the world's worst memory.
Uh-huh.
So if I have a name where the first name is the same letter as the second name, if I can think of one of the names, it gives me a clue to what the other name will start with, and it makes it easier. For instance, if I say Bruce, what the hell was his last name? It began with B. Oh, yeah, Banner. But if his name was Wilson, Bruce, what would lead me to Wilson? I'd never think of his name.
Okay.
He'd only be, if I remembered Bruce, he'd only be Bruce to me.
Well, that's interesting. So we've got Scott Summers as well. But there's no alliteration with Charles Xavier.
Charles Xavier.
Yeah, where did that name
occasionally
come from?
A man slips up.
You can't forget Charles Xavier, though, right?
No, I thought that Charles Xavier would... who's Charles Xavier?
Oh, he's the guy who...
Is he the guy at the school?
Yeah, the guy at the school. Yeah.
I didn't realize. Did I give him the first name Charles?
Yeah.
I just thought of him as Xavier.
Okay.
somebody else must have written that Charles in there. See, now you got me all upset. I have to find out somebody else who wrote a future story must have called him Charles.
Absolutely.
Well, maybe I did. I can't remember.
Okay, excellent.
The X-Men, that's one of our books, right?
That's it.
Okay, I remember.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. I'll do a spreadsheet for you. But at that time as well, you've made so many amazing characters, created so many amazing characters that live on today.
I like the sound of that.
We're going in a good place here. But at the time, it was in the 1960s, and you were coming up with new characters on a virtually daily basis. You must have had no idea they were going to live on this long. Did you think that they were just going to last maybe 1 year, 2 years, 3 years
I
max?
I hope the first issue would sell, so I'd keep my job. You never know. I mean, you bring out a book, and then I'd wait breathlessly for a month. It took that long to get the sales figures.
Yeah.
And at the end of the month, my publisher would either say, "All right, Stan, do a second issue of this. It's all right." Or he'd say, "Boy, that was a bomb. Don't write any more of this anymore." Fortunately, he hasn't said that, so it was all right.
Okay. But you weren't really thinking of legacy.
No, I wasn't thinking legacy. I was thinking, can I pay the goddamn rent?
It worked out okay.
Legacy.
It worked out okay.
I'm in there buying groceries and figuring out my budget, and my God, we got to get a cheaper rent than this, and you're talking legacy.
I'm not going to ask. Well, I am going to ask you, but they say you should never pick a favorite, I guess, but...
It's hard to pick a favorite, but you're going to ask me, and the answer is Spider-Man.
Yeah, there we go. Why Spidey?
I like Spider-Man because he's the most recognizable. Anywhere in the world, you have a picture of Spider-Man, people know who he is.
Yeah.
It's sort of like Disney used to have Mickey Mouse or the Coca-Cola bottle. You'd see it anywhere, you knew what it was.
Yeah.
Somehow or other, Spider-Man has become world famous. And Spider-Man costumes are best-selling costumes on Halloween for kids practically all over the world. And, of course, I'm so smart, I never had a costume factory. I never did a Spider-Man costume. Everybody's making all the dough but me.
Just a couple of last things, Dan. This fascinates me. In the 1970s, you wrote two screenplays with the French director...
Alain René,
yeah. Which were never made. They were never made.
It was a funny thing. It was called The Monster Maker, I think.
Uh-huh.
It was all... In those days, people were worried about pollution.
Uh-huh.
So I got the idea to treat pollution as if it's a monster. There's a monster called pollution. And it was more sophisticated than that, but I'm breaking it down.
Cause of course.
I know your audience doesn't like to do deep thinking.
We don't do sophistication.
No, I know. So anyway, I wrote the screenplay.
Yeah.
Alain loved it. And we took it to a guy named Martin Ransohoff,
uh-huh.
who was the head of a company called Filmways. I don't know how I remember that. I've got no memory in that I remember. That was years ago. And Martin Ransohoff read the screenplay.
Yeah.
And he said, "I like this. This is good.
Yeah.
But of course, you'll cut at least half of the dialogue." Because I had never written a screenplay before. And I had these people talking like I'm talking now. They were going on endlessly, speech after speech. And they don't do that in movies.
Yeah.
So... I said okay, but then my friend Alain, who was sitting next to me, ruined both our careers by saying, "Stan will not change a word of it." My luck, Alain loved it as it was. No producer loved it as it was because it was too long. But Alain didn't. He was such a purist. He wanted every word there the way I had written it. So that script is still hanging around somewhere, and... If I could find it, I bet I could auction it off and get 20 or 30 bucks for it.
I think it could be, you could get in touch with some of your filmmaker buddies. We could have this movie in cinemas by next year.
Yeah.
We could make it happen.
First thing I got to do is find the script. It's something like 300 pages long.
Oh, well, it'll be a big pile, a big manuscript. You can check that out.
But that's the story. Alain was a great guy. He was a brilliant man, and he did some wonderful movies. And he had really come over here to America to see if he could get to direct the Spider-Man movie.
Wow.
He was one of the first people who thought it would be good to have a movie about Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And I assume that he spoke to whoever made those decisions in those days, and they decided not to do the movie. So then he was stuck with me with my pollution movie. He was a funny guy. He always wore a red shirt.
Yeah.
Every time you'd see him, he had a red shirt. And one of the biggest mysteries of the time was, is it the same red shirt and he washes it every night and puts it on in the morning? Or does he have a lot of red shirts? We never figured that out.
Well, it's the old Albert Einstein thing, isn't it? He had the same suit a dozen times.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So you would just wear the same thing every day.
Oh, this is the kind of interview I like, where I learn something.
And you said we don't do deep thinking. Amazing. I just want to ask one last thing about the Alain René.
This is the 15th time he said, I want to ask one last thing. I hope you're keeping count.
You've spotted my technique. I like it. The Alain René relationship that you struck up with him,
we were best friends.
That fascinates me. And well, it's just he's a French filmmaker. I wouldn't have necessarily thought that he would be into comic books, one word.
Into comic books. He was into me and the intellectual things we discussed, like baseball.
Yeah, and The Monster Maker, which is... It was also about creation, wasn't it, Stan? It was about creation as well. It was about...
I threw everything. It was about everything you could think of.
Oh, man, we need to get this movie made.
It would be nice.
And what's next for you?
Well, to finish this interview, and then to ask my partner, Max, what we do next. Max, it tells me where to go and what to do. And I'm going to kill you for putting me next to a guy who asked me such a long interview. He said, I'll just take a minute, Stan.
Next, we're going over there. Stan, it's been a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure with you. Left hand.
We're doing left hand. Remember?
That's very considerate.
That was pretty good. I like
that. I ought to give my mouth a rest with the talking, too.
Stan Lee, mother effing Lee.
What a legend.
Thanks, man.
Stan Lee, not you.
Easy mistake to make.
Did you crack out your...
I beg your pardon. Finish the sentence.
Your Stan Lee impression.
No, I didn't. No. I would never do an impression of someone to their face. A, because it would make them realize how bad their voices are.
Sure.
Like how spot on mine is and how poor theirs is in comparison.
Sure.
They'd have to adopt a new voice.
They'd have to, Stanley would hear me going, "Show greetings to everyone, I'm Stan Lee." And he'd go, "Oh my word, I've got to talk like this now." See?
Wow, that was
British?
Two impressions of Stan Lee, and both of them were terrible.
Brilliant.
That's amazing.
I'm Stan Lee. I live in London. Greetings, Spidey fans. Nuff said, true believers.
It's changing as you go. It's a fascinating evolution for a 94-year-old man.
He's still finding his voice, Helen.
Still to be finding his voice.
At 94 years old, you can still find your voice. That's, you can still be who you were meant to be. Thank you. But he was awesome. He was amazing. And he's still sharp as a tack, which is great. Right, should we move on then from Stan Lee? I don't want to gloat about that too much. Should we talk about some movie news?
Yeah.
Let's do it, yeah. Probably the big news this week was the James Bond the James Bond news. First of all, we have a release date for 2019. And there is also the news of a apparent alleged director shortlist. So on it are Yann Demange from 71.
Mm-hmm.
We also have David Mackenzie, obviously Hell or High Water.
Ooh.
Denis Villeneuve. Obviously Blade Runner coming up and Sicario and Arrival behind him. People keep saying Christopher Nolan. He is not on this shortlist.
That doesn't mean there isn't another shortlist. If you're Eon, right? If you're Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson, you probably have a really short list, which is just two words.
And one of them is Christopher.
Yeah, and the other one is Hugh Nolan.
There you go.
And then there's a longer short list, which is all those other gentlemen.
Yes.
But they're all gentlemen, aren't they?
They are all gentlemen. Mm. Well, yeah, it's Bond. But do we think, like, let's just get
the directors.
Can we just talk about the Christopher Nolan thing for a minute? Because Christopher Nolan is the kind of guy who wants to do things his way. And in fairness, he has earned the right to do things exactly as he wants, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So is that something that any Bond director has ever had? Because you remember back in the day, Quentin Tarantino was... you know, keen to do a Bond, or he said he was.
Yes.
And they were obviously wary of handing the reins over to someone with that much profile of his own.
Yeah, especially since what he wanted to do was
unusual.
Unusual. He wanted to do a black and white version of Casino Royale set in the 1960s with Casino Royale playing himself, with Pierce Brosnan as Bond, even though he was already Bond in the modern continuity at that point.
Well, yeah, okay, so that was unusual. But honestly, I feel like Nolan is, again, he's a bit bigger than they'd necessarily be comfortable with. I think they prefer directors who, I'm not saying that these are, they're all auteurs, they're all, you know, filmmakers of considerable standing, but they tend not to have quite as much clout in the industry as he does.
I would say that Sam Mendes bucked that trend. I would say that especially on Spectre, Sam Mendes did what Sam Mendes wanted to do. However, you're right, Chris Nolan makes it a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
Chris Nolan becomes a Chris Nolan movie. Yeah.
That's exactly it. And they aren't Chris Nolan movies, they are Bond movies.
Yeah.
I think he said in an interview that he's interested in the idea of it, but he's at a point in his career where he's only interested in doing original things now. I don't think he wants to take on another franchise. He's done Batman. I don't think he needs to work in that system anymore.
And at least two of his Batman films are arguably Bond films anyway. So yeah. I think these other names are actually good and really encouraging. They're all great filmmakers.
Yeah.
They've done really interesting kind of action work and character work with the action work at the same time.
Yeah.
So I'd be pretty excited about any of those guys.
I mean, I'm very intrigued at the thought of a Denis Villeneuve Bond movie. I think from what it sounds like, Yann Demange is the front runner, and he directed 71, which, if you haven't seen it, is a fantastic sort of Northern Ireland set thriller with Jack O'Connell, and that has all the makings of a really interesting, gritty, kinetic, down to earth Bond. I think he would be a really good fit if he is indeed the front runner. But we shall see. We shall see.
Yeah, we shall see about, what, 2 minutes after the Empire podcast hits the...
Probably. Hits the airwaves. I mean, we've got 24 months of Bond news to come, so we really have to pace ourselves here, don't we?
We do. They all seem to have fine choices. The big question, of course, is it going to be Danny Craig? Is he going to be coming back? And is anyone going to call him Danny to his face?
Never, so. Chris. No. Literally never.
No. I get nervous with Daniel, quite frankly.
Mr. Craig, sir!
What do you think? Is he going to come back? There's the scuttlebutt in that Variety
article. That seems to be the word. Everyone was saying earlier in the week that the New York Times had confirmed his return. I don't think that's something that the New York Times does. I think that's something that Eon does.
Yeah.
But it's certainly looking good for his return, I think, at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't be surprised if he returned. It is the 25th Bond. I think this will be a bigger splash than usual. So I'd imagine that he'd want to do that. And also, Spectre was not as good critically or commercially, I would say, received as well as Skyfall was.
Correct.
So perhaps he wants to go out on a high. Right now, I think he has a 50% track record as Bond, and perhaps he wants to go out with 60% chance. A 60% success rate.
Thanks, Chris.
Which would be Roger Moore's one. Seven films. And four of them are good. Four into seven doesn't go. Wait, no, it does. Carry the three.
Four out of seven.
He has a 4 out of 7 success rate.
That's pretty good.
And that is mathematically sound. So there we go. James Bond coming. And we're going to get him early as well.
Yes, so it's
we're going to get him early.
It's what, 8th of November in the US.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
giving it a few weeks play before Wonder Woman comes along and bashes it in the skull, and it will probably be sort of Halloween time then here, or just the week just before. Sometimes 2 weeks, isn't it, for Bond? Not one.
Yes,
it's 2 weeks. Yeah,
yeah. Usually
2 weeks. That's exciting. Well done, everybody. All right, what's next? What's happening?
James Cameron and Terminator. So back in January, there was news that James Cameron was trying to take back control of the Terminator franchise in the future. He, at that point, was said to be developing one movie with Tim Miller of Deadpool fame attached to direct. But now, of course, potentially, of course, he's talking about more than one. A 3-film arc to reinvent the franchise. The question is, he says, has the franchise run its course, or can it be freshened up? Can it still have relevance now, where so much of our world is catching up to what was science fiction in the first two films? Mm-hmm. We live in a world of predator drones and surveillance and big data and emergent AI. So he's in discussions with David Ellison, who is the current right holder globally. Mm-hmm. The rights in the US market apparently revert to Cameron in a year and a half. So he's talking to Ellison about seeing what they can do. And they're leaning towards a 3-film arc.
Of course they are.
Now, Cameron should be, in theory, busy with a, was it four film arc, five film arc of Avatar films?
Uh-huh.
So, you know, this is not to say he personally is going to be taking the reins on this, but leaning towards another Terminator trilogy.
Yeah. Which he's not going to direct, clearly, right? He's not going to direct them at the same time. But he is Jim Cameron. He's probably found a way of having a 36-hour day that he can split his time equally between Avatars and Terminators.
Yeah.
I don't know.
The thing is, the last two, maybe arguably three, of the Terminator films have not been great. And each one has sort of tried to reinvent the franchise, and each one has sort of not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So at what point do we, you know, is it more fool us? Like, at what point do we just think this is
stop
not,
trying to
maybe
reinvent
stop.
The wheel?
Mm. Maybe just leave it. Terminator 2 is a perfect film.
If you have the answers to that, I mean, like, write in on the back of a postcard, please.
We won't read it.
We could read it.
It's Jim Cameron. It's Jim Cameron.
It is Jim
Cameron. And it's the whole thing. You don't write off the Avatar sequels, even though, you know, it is easy to poo-poo them. I certainly know I've thrown poo-poo in that general direction in the past, but he's proved us wrong constantly.
Yeah.
And I suspect if anyone can save the Terminator series from itself, it's him. Him Cameron.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. So I'm kind of intrigued to see what they do. Of course, the Terminator movies are now five of them, and three of them have been bad, which means that there's been a 40% chance. 40% chance of me understanding the maths of this.
Correct.
40% success rate. There you go. So with James Cameron on board, I could make six films, and if three of them are good, then that's a
50%
success
rate.
There
you go. Yes. Good boy, Chris.
Gold star.
Oh, dear. Hey, other news. Christopher McQuarrie, formerly of this podcast. No, not right here, right now. I mean, he's busy making a Mission Impossible film. But he is planning his next move, which is a much smaller project called The Chameleon, which is based on this amazing true life story, which he's adapting with Terrence Winter. Now, if you haven't read the story, I mean, it's a spoiler for the film, obviously, so if you're spoiler pure, don't go near it. But it's a New Yorker feature written by David Gran, and it's the story of a French con man who became a serial impersonator of missing teenagers.
Oh, yes.
And he lived with a Texas family as their formerly missing brother for quite some time in the 1990s, and had this bizarre run of, I don't want to call it success because it's such a weird thing to do, but this bizarre run of sort of inveigling his way into safe places as by pretending to be someone completely different. Mm. So it's a sort of a Catch Me If You Can, but much, much weirder than that, actually.
6 degrees of separation-y.
Yes. Yeah, that's
catch
a good...
Catch Me If You Can-y. So do we know this is going to be McQuarrie's next movie as a director, or is he going to do something else?
We know he's adapting it. We know he's working on it with Winter. We know that it's going to be a bit of a family affair since Heather McQuarrie is producing, and Winter's wife, Rachel Winter, is also producing. So it's kind of a group thing. We assume it's going to be his next film, but I don't know if it's going to come immediately after this or not.
Cool. Well, we look forward to the 8-hour Empire Podcast spoiler special on
Absolutely.
That one. I have an interesting one. It's not really big news, but I want to talk about it anyway because I just love it. So there's an interesting report in Variety this week about Justice League, which is having a few reshoots, which is quite a common thing for movies of that size.
Completely normal.
It doesn't mean it's in trouble or anything. It's just they're just having to do reshoots. But one of the issues with doing reshoots after the fact is that you have to juggle stars' schedules. You know, the stars are busy. They have other films they're working on. This might be a bit of a spoiler, potentially, but I don't think it is. Like, maybe put on your spoiler headphones now, but Henry Cavill is in Justice League. Oh, my God, what? What? Superman's not dead? What? The soil rising from the grave? What?
It's probably just a flashback, right?
It's a flashback. He's definitely dead.
He's definitely dead.
He's definitely dead.
Yeah. I like it.
Anyway, Henry Cavill is in Justice League, and according to Variety,
this is the greatest story in the world.
He's been he's having to switch between shooting on the Justice League reshoots and Mission Impossible 6.
That's fine, right?
Is this like the scene in Superman 4, The Quest for Peace, where Superman and Clark Kent have a double date in the same restaurant and he has to keep rushing back and forth between the tables?
Yeah. But you know the way that Superman wears, or Clark Kent wears glasses to differentiate himself from Superman?
Yes.
So you need something that makes you look different in each role.
You do.
Unfortunately, Henry Cavill's look for Mission Impossible 6 includes a mustache.
Yep.
And what's interesting is that there was obviously some like negotiation between the studios on this mustache, and Paramount, who make Mission Impossible, would not back down.
This is the report.
According to Variety sources, not confirmed, that Paramount don't want the mustache shaved off, so it will be digitally removed in Justice League's post-production.
If this is true, this is the most gloriously petty thing I've heard in a long, long time. It would be easier and quicker to shave the mustache off, go back to the Mission Impossible 6 set, and have them put on a fake mustache, rather than the thousands of dollars that Warner Brothers are going to have to spend on digitally removing the mustache, or maybe keeping the mustache and digitally erasing Henry Cavill. I'm not entirely sure how it's going to work, but it's just I kind of admire that.
That's amazing.
I mean, I really want it to be true because it's just one of the most fascinating stories ever. It's wonderful if it's true.
Or just have Superman have a mustache and no one comments on it.
But like just in random scenes through the film.
Mid conversation, he suddenly grows a mustache.
Yeah. He's just come back from the dead. We don't know how Kryptonian biology works.
Exactly.
Could absolutely sprout a tash. But that's interesting. Also, very, very quickly this week, we had John Powell confirmed as the composer for the untitled Han Solo movie, which is interesting.
Well, his work on How to Train Your Dragon is gorgeous, so I'm kind of behind
that. How to Train Your Wookiee.
That would... I don't think you train a Wookiee. I mean, he's, you know... He's a
you let the Wookiee win.
Well, yeah, but that's training people to react to Wookiees, I think.
Oh, right, okay.
There was weird... And Paul, we're talking about mega franchises here. There is news about the Barbie movie. What? We were talking mega franchises. Anne Hathaway is apparently lined up to play something in the Barbie movie.
You have my curiosity. Now you still have my curiosity and...
Like, what the heck?
Yeah,
Amy Schumer was apparently in line for this, which was another what the heck moment, if we're honest. And this hasn't been verified or anything, but apparently talks are underway now with Anne Hathaway for the same role. I don't even understand what this movie is, I'll be honest. I don't understand, is it like someone playing with Barbies or is she literally going to be playing Barbie? Is it an animated movie that she's going to be voicing? I don't understand.
Nobody
but apparently
knows.
They've been churning through scripts and concepts. Everybody thinks they have something that will work and an idea that would appeal to big stars.
Okay.
But we don't know. The director is Althea Jones, who's got Fun Mom Dinner coming up with Molly Shannon people. So hopefully that's good. But she's apparently in talks to direct. But everything else, who knows?
So apparently, I'm just reading this now, the premise for the movie was the story would center on a Barbie who, after she is exiled from a world full of Barbies, enters the real world as a normal woman who is imperfect.
Okay.
So enchanted, but with Barbie.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, all right. I'm listening. I'm paying attention.
I'm confused.
I mean, I'm also that.
She enters the world as a woman who's imperfect. Who do we get to play this woman who is imperfect? Anne Hathaway. two very, very quick news stories to touch upon. Nicholas Holt, Nicky Holty, is going to play a young J.R.R. Tolkien, now we're Tolkien, in a biopic.
Yeah,
which
that's...
is presumably going to be called The Lord of the Rings, or...
I don't know. That's a slightly weird one to me, because I've read some Tolkien biographies, and I don't remember his early life being that exciting. Obviously, he did serve in World War One, so there's you know, inherent drama in that, I guess, but it's not a life that seemed filled with incident to me. Having said that, I'm intrigued. He was an interesting guy, so fingers crossed.
Okay, and Wonder Woman 2, as you mentioned, Helen.
Yes.
Has a release date. Did they announce this this week, or was this...
Yeah.
I think it came out of Comic-Con,
Okay. December 13th, 2019.
So long.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yay. But they still haven't technically confirmed Patty Jenkins, to the best of my knowledge. So they need to get on that.
She's contractually signed, it says here. So I imagine...
Let's hope.
She'll be doing it.
Yeah.
Exciting.
Sure.
Good Christmas present. So there we go. That's all the movie news is fit to print. And we should have our second guest.
Hmm.
And then we should just go straight into the reviews because we're crazy like that. So the second guest this week is one of the stars of one of my favorite sitcoms on TV, Silicon Valley. He is also a stand-up. He has been a podcast host in the past as well. Not this podcast, obviously. And he is, of course, now the star and co-writer of the brilliant... No, whoops, I ruined the review section. Brilliant rom-com, The Big Sick. He is, of course, Kumail Nanjiani. And it's a fascinating story, this movie, The Big Sick. If you don't know what it's about, he basically plays himself and he enters into a relationship with a lady who then gets sick and enters a coma. And he has to deal with that and with her parents and the feelings that he's feeling. And it's made equally more poignant and funny by the fact that it's actually true. And the co-writer of this movie, Emily Fee Gordon, is Kumail's wife and they've been married for 10 years. And she did indeed lapse into a coma soon after they started dating, and so this is a wonderful movie, and he was very, very funny and perceptive and maybe even profound about it. So naturally I had to match that profundity with my own profundity.
Oh,
and I hope you enjoy the profundity that's about to unfold. Here's Kumail Nanjiani.
We are delighted to be joined on the Emperor podcast by Kumail Nanjiani. How are you, sir? You all right?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm not too bad, not too bad. I'm wearing Bruce Campbell's face. Have you ever met someone who's wearing a t-shirt of your face?
No, I don't think there are any t-shirts of my face. Actually, I just saw people will make Silicon Valley. Like, there's a lot of fan art out there.
Uh-huh.
And I have seen... Actually, we just did a shoot where we dressed as, like, the outsiders. And I saw a girl... turn it into a dress, and it was like my face on her dress. So that's the only time I've seen it. Oh, actually, Emily and I had a podcast called The Indoor Kids, which is about video games. Uh-huh. And there was a lot of cool, really beautiful fan art of that. And there are a lot of t-shirts of that, but not a picture of my face except for that one dress. It's usually a drawing.
How would you deal with a situation like that where someone, if you were talking to someone, say, like, I walked in here.
Yeah.
With a picture of your face on my chest. How would you deal with that?
It would be strange. I would think I was like sort of staring at myself, which kind of feels like that because there's a poster of our movie here and it kind of looks like I'm looking at myself and it's very disconcerting. Truly, I hate it.
Do you want to move seats? Are you okay?
No, it's okay. And I could see that my head is photoshopped on there and I can tell.
It
is, because I know what the real picture is and I know what they did and I can just see how it doesn't look like me. And this is a very self-involved thing, but I just, like, whenever I see it, I see, like, let's stop breaking down the poster.
Well, so you and Zoe, I know we've got to start now, you've started. So you and Zoe weren't in the room at the same time.
We were in the room.
You were.
But I think they liked the way that Zoe's face looked in that shot, but not mine, so they changed my head. And so my head, I think, is very slightly bigger than my actual head. Certain parts of my face are a little bigger than my actual face.
Uh-huh.
Like, my jaw is a little bigger in that poster than it is in real life. So, I mean...
It's jutting. It's a jutting jaw.
It's jutting, and in real life, it's not quite as jutting. So it's... Don't look at me like that. I can feel you... comparing.
No, it's fine. It's good. It's good.
It's just strange to have, because, you know, we've been doing a lot of press and these posters that are up everywhere, and it's just strange to see them all over the place.
But you like the poster. Imagine if you were in the room with a poster that you didn't, really, really didn't like. I mean, that would be hell.
I can't imagine what it would be like to promote something that I didn't like.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, this is a lot of work. I get to talk to great people, and most people that I talk to really have loved the movie, so that's really good. I cannot imagine what this must be like for, like, big stars who go out. Because I've seen, I'm not going to name them, but you see someone you're a big fan of on, like, The Tonight Show promoting something that they clearly don't like. And that must be a soul-shattering experience day after day.
And they just tick that box. That's another one off the old contractual obligation list. And on to the next one.
Yeah. So I'm glad that at least this is something that I can truly... be proud of.
It works both ways, I have to say. There are times when you're interviewing someone and you do not like the film.
Right.
And you do anything but talk about the film. You talk around the film.
Oh, that must be nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
So you go in, you're like, so this thing you did 5 years ago was pretty good.
Pretty much. What you also have to do is you have to avoid congratulating the person on a film that you don't like. Uh-huh. If you're going to then tear it apart on a podcast later on.
Oh my God. Yeah. You have to be very careful.
Because that could be a default position. You come into a room sometimes and you go, because you don't know what to say. Sometimes you just desperately searching for small talk and you just go, congratulations on the film. I love the film. Damn it. It's too late. It's too late. Yeah, you can't take it back.
I will let you know that every time you don't congratulate someone, they know exactly what's happening. I don't think you're fooling anyone. I think they know, like, all right, he didn't congratulate me. I know exactly what this is because he's going to rip me on a podcast later.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, I think it's fine. It's a strange thing, you know, talking to people whose job is to evaluate what you do.
Yeah.
And you have to do, you have to be objective about your job. It's a complicated thing, both sides.
And now I've realized I haven't congratulated on this film.
Yeah,
I know. Which is the horrible lingering elephant in the room.
I know.
Genuinely, and I can look you in the eye because I can't often look people in the eye and say this. I love the film. It's amazing. It's fantastic.
Thank you. I know Sam Bain a little bit, and I saw you guys talking on Twitter about
it. Yes, that's right.
Because Sam saw it about a week ago, and I'm a huge fan of his. I love Peep Show.
He's a good guy.
And you know, Four Lions, and I'm just So. So it's very exciting that he liked the film. And you moderated our Q&A last night.
I did. Full disclosure. I'm in the camp. I'm inside.
Well, you liked it. That's great.
No, I mean, Sam tweeted me literally as I was about to go into a screening of it, saying, it's fantastic. You will love it. And I did, which was great, which is nice.
Oh, good.
It's always nice. No, it's a fantastic film. And obviously, it's so deeply, intensely personal to you that I imagine it must be closer to you than anything else you've done before. Is this fair to say?
Yes, 100%. By far the most personal thing. By far the thing that I'm most in is this. By far. And I hope this will be
physically and emotionally.
Physically, emotionally, in every single way. By far the most personal. I mean, most people go their whole careers without ever doing anything this personal. And for me, because sometimes people will write something personal, but then they won't be on screen doing it.
Yeah.
It's such a strange thing to write something so personal. Me and Emily wrote it.
Yeah.
But she always says, she's like, at least I'm not up on screen. You're up on screen in this really personal thing, going through really personal things.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, that's also what I enjoy about it. I mean, it's a little almost too nakedly personal, but I like to try and, you know, put myself into everything I do. I enjoy that. There's a joy in sharing of yourself, sharing parts of yourself with people. I think someone else saying, I really connected with this part of you, it can be very joyful.
Absolutely, but in the writing process, we've talked about this a little bit. Were there things that you didn't want to put into the film that were too close to the bone, or were you very, very open and honest about the situation in this movie?
It was steps. I remember that when we were first writing it, we've been writing it for a while, and there were certain days where I would procrastinate and not write certain scenes. I wouldn't write, and I really was like, all right, why am I not writing this scene? And it was clearly, oh, this is emotionally very difficult to revisit. And I remember we've been working with Judd for a while, and it was just one of the projects on his back burner. You know, it wasn't like, it wasn't fully known that we would make it. And so I saw Judd at a party, and I was like, you know, there are certain scenes I just can't write. I can't do it. Any advice? And he was like, you just have to bust through the wall. He's like, you just have to. He's like, that's what the good stuff is. Like, if you're having a hard time writing it, that means that's what the good stuff is. And he's like, there's no trick. You just have to sit down and you just have to write through it.
Yeah, sure.
So that was just understanding that someone else understood the challenge and the difficulty was very helpful.
Yeah.
And that's what it really turned how I wrote, turned it around for me. I would just like sit down and be like, this is very hard to write, but just write it. And the other thing that helped me was not trying to write it well, just write it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it can be very easy to be like, oh, this is an experience I went through and it's so profound to me and the writing has to be just as profound. I think that's a trap. I think you just try and write it and then try and rewrite it and rewrite it and rewrite it and trust that at some point it'll get good. But there are sometimes you write, I think writing is a weird mix of intellectual and emotional exercise. Sometimes you write something that you're very emotional while you're writing it.
Yes.
And somehow that stays even through all the rewriting and everything. And then sometimes when people watch it,
yeah.
they feel that emotion that you first felt when you first wrote that line. That was a very simple line or something, but you wrote it and it made you feel something. And sometimes it's possible to preserve that and have somebody else experience that years later when they're watching it. It's pretty magical.
It's extraordinary. The thing that surprised me about the movie, I mean, given the subject matter, it probably in hindsight shouldn't have been as surprising, but how moving the film is. It is a comedy and it remains a comedy all the way through, but there is a gear switch.
Yes.
Definitely towards the end, especially as your character begins to experience emotional epiphanies.
Yes.
It gets really, really tough in the old tear ducts.
Oh, good.
Was that something that...
I like hearing that.
Yeah. Was that something that you and Emily wanted to craft in particular, and Michael, obviously, the director?
For sure. That was something we talked about a lot, and it's also something that I've been working on in my personal life. I think, you know, to me, the movie's about a lot. I think one of the things that it is about is how guys... the only emotion that I think a lot of guys feel comfortable expressing is anger.
Yeah.
And I think, and Emily, sort of talking with Emily, I understood, like, every emotion can turn into anger. Sadness can turn into anger. Happiness can turn into aggression. You know, you watch, like, people at, you know, watching, like, sports or something. Yeah! Getting really angry. You could see it turn.
What do you mean by that?
So for me, part of it was also about this guy who hasn't ever been able to express his emotions or feel his emotions.
Yeah.
Learning to feel his emotions and being comfortable feeling his sadness. The sadness that I think he's a tremendously sad person from the beginning of the movie to the end. Tremendously conflicted and tremendously sad. And learning to feel that sadness at the end. And learning to be okay with feeling the sadness. That's part of like the arc of this character.
Yeah, yeah.
So really wanted that to be a big part of it. Like him feeling sadness and being okay with feeling sadness. And learning to feel sadness through his interactions with Emily. But more interactions with Emily's parents.
Yes,
and understanding that. The struggle that he has, that he hasn't even been able to articulate to himself, is a struggle that everybody has. That's what life is. Life is like, it's a series of struggles, and you do the best you can. I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that.
No.
I think the struggles of life can be very beautiful.
They can. But I was just saying, picturing that on an inspirational quote poster.
Right.
Life is a series of struggles, and yeah. You do the best you can.
Do the best you can. Yeah. Sometimes inspirational posters can be like more like a defeatist poster, a non-inspirational poster. Everything sucks. Good luck. You're gonna need it.
This would be a mug, but a broken mug.
Exactly.
Just a little chip on the side of it.
Oh, there's like an imperceptible hole in the bottom of the mug. And it's got like the saying on top, like, everything sucks. Enjoy it.
Drink up quickly because you never know when it's going to run out.
That's exactly right.
That's profound as well. I can be profound too. Look at that.
It really is.
Just very, very quickly, two quick last things. As someone who played cricket for my local team.
Were you good? What were you?
Years, I was a medium bowler. And the worst batsman in the world.
Really? Okay.
Truly, truly terrible.
You were not an all-rounder.
I wasn't an all-rounder, no, but I was medium fast. Should we give me... I'll
pretty
build
good?
Myself up a little bit. Pretty good. Yeah.
Were you a tail-ender? Like, you would go up at the end?
I was 11, yeah.
All right.
I was absolutely... I was golden duck almost every single time.
Wow.
Amazing. But it's great to see cricket positions being explained in a movie because, like I say, I played for my local team for 2 years and I still don't understand every position on the pitch.
I know. I mean, it is truly, you know, Americans make fun of cricket a lot,
mm-hmm.
and it's our fault. Silly mid-on, silly mid-off, Yorker, these are real terms.
Yep, absolutely.
Gully, yep. Sticky wicket.
Sticky wicket, square leg.
I mean, these are all real. These are all real terms. Yeah. It sounds goofy, and they're like, what, doesn't it last like 3 days? I'm like, actually, it lasts 5 days, six if you count the day off in the middle. It's changed a little bit now, but yeah, I loved cricket, you know, I remember when Pakistan won the World Cup in 92. That was one of like the happiest memories of my life. Wasim Akram was my favorite cricketer of all time. You know Wasim Akram.
Absolutely. Were you happy and then angry? Were you, yeah!
Yeah, it was like, just turn it all into anger.
I love success.
Yeah, I loved Wasim Akram, and I loved, I was a batsman. I was.
Oh, really?
I would bowl a little bit, but I wasn't very good. I could keep line and length, but once they figured it out, there was no pace. I couldn't spin. But I was an okay batsman, never like great.
Uh-huh.
But like, okay, I'd have moments, you know, and I really wanted to be a cricketer when I was
a kid. Are there LA teams? Can you play in LA? Is it?
Yeah, but I haven't played for long enough that now they're so much better than me. They're so much better.
All right. Well, if ever you're back next time, we'll get a cricket team together. We'll make it work.
I would love to play. Well, in Pakistan, on the streets, we just play. I don't know if you guys do this, but it's just a tennis ball mm-hmm. that you tape over with electrical tape, and then you play it on the streets. That's how like Javed Miandad and everybody
Amazing.
Became great cricketers. That's why a lot of like Pakistani players are good at playing like straight because uh-huh. they play it on the streets.
And you have to avoid the buildings.
Yeah, you have to like hit it over the. Yeah.
I did the same. I learned at the side of my house. I had to avoid. So that's why I'm a terrible batsman, because again I was just hitting down the garden,
yeah.
not towards the window where my mum would have been furious.
Right, yeah, so, I've broken a lot of windows.
A lot of windows, indeed. And then the very last thing is Silicon Valley. I'm a huge fan. Obviously, season 4 is just finished. You start season 5 in October.
Yeah, we start shooting in October.
Yeah. So obviously the departure of TJ Miller has changed the dynamic of the show. Are you looking forward in a way to what season 5 might allow you guys in terms of opportunities?
They just started writing, so I don't know what the specifics are. I am curious to see, as you said, TJ, so funny, and Ehrlich Bachmann was such a great character, but and such an integral part of the show. I think the dynamic of the show obviously changes a little bit. Mm. So I am very, very sad to see TJ go. I loved working with him, and you know, he's one of my best friends. I talk to him all the time. So I won't miss him because I'll still be around him a lot. I will miss working with him. But it is interesting to see, you know, it's easy for comedies to, and I love this show, but I think it's easy for comedies to sort of fall into a formula, and our show hasn't done that. But it's a nice challenge for the writers to see, you know, how to keep the show the same but different. So I'm curious to see what happens.
I'm looking forward to the sexual tension between Dinesh and Guilfoyle being paid off at long last.
I mean,
want you crazy kids to get it on. I mean,
that would be truly amazing. Speaking of fan art, look up Dinesh Guilfoyle fan art.
I don't. I'm scared.
People have drawn parts of me that nobody has seen.
That are not on the big sick poster.
They're not on the big sick poster, no.
All right, okay.
That only my wife and God have seen.
And on that bombshell, Kamel, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's Kamel Nanjiani talking about the big sick. And we should start our reviews section by talking about the big sick. John.
Yes, the big sick. As you say, this is a sort of romantic comedy. And a semi-autobiographical romantic comedy from Kamel Nanjiani, who we just heard from. So he sort of plays a version of himself, as is often the case with comedians, a stand-up comedian, sort of struggling his way through the Chicago comedy scene. When at one of his gigs, he gets heckled by a woman played by Zoe Kazan, and they start start dating. And it's sparkly, it's fresh. They have a nice relationship going. It's quite sort of familiar rom-com tropes, I suppose, to begin with. But there's a couple of things that set this apart from your average rom-com. One is the fact that there's this sort of cross-cultural relationship. Mm-hmm. So Kumail's character sort of struggles with his immigrant's heritage. His parents are very traditional Pakistanis who want him to marry a traditional Muslim woman. So they set up these really awkward dinner dates with eligible women mm-hmm. When he just wants to date this white girl. And the second little wrinkle is that his girlfriend suddenly falls into a coma out of nowhere, which, as Chris has mentioned earlier, this actually happens to his real-life later wife.
I mean, this is a massive spoiler that, you know, she lives.
It is a massive. Her existence is a massive spoiler, but she does live. I mean, this is a romantic comedy. There are no prizes for guessing that everyone lives happily ever after. But
spoiler.
It is a, you know, boy meets girl, girl loses boy, girl falls into a coma. You can probably guess the rest.
Right.
But it's a very smart movie, and it feels like a very authentic movie. There are those rom-com tropes, but it's done very intelligently, observed very well. It has a lot to say about this sort of immigrant experience in America, and a lot to say about the experience of a loved one in hospital. You know, a lot of the film is Kamal spending time with his girlfriend's parents, who are played by Ray Romano and Holly Hunter. And there's some really lovely scenes where they're just waiting, and you know, they're forced into this strange scenario where they have to get to know each other. And it's really, really sweetly funny. It's genuinely funny as well. Mm. There's some real laugh out loud moments. I think what's good about it is it feels real. It feels authentic. And I guess that's because it is.
Yeah.
But it's a very likable movie, and not one you usually see in this genre. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought this movie was terrific. I usually have an allergic reaction to Judd Apatow produced comedies of this ilk, like The 5-Year Engagement, which, as we know, felt like it was playing out in real time. This is 40. Oh, my God. And, but this, I thought, was really, really great. And it feels written, whereas a lot of these Apatow-produced movies feel largely improvised. And this one, the script by Kamal Nanjiani and Emily Fee Gordon, is very tight, very controlled, gives great roles to everybody. Zoe Kazan's not in the movie a great deal, but when she is in it, she shines. Ray Romano, I think, is terrific in this. Holly Hunter's terrific as well. And, it's a really, really good, really moving film that moved me a great deal, but also never stopped making me laugh. And I cannot recommend it highly enough. Which is obviously why we gave it 4 stars. 4 stars, though, for the big sake. It is a fantastic film, well worthy of your time. Hellspells, what's next? It's a big, big old scary shark film, isn't it?
A big scary shark film, yes. Sharks film, in fact. It's a bit of a nightmare scenario, this one. So we have two sisters.
It's called 47 Meters Down. I forgot to mention that. Yeah. Should mention that. The name of the film is 47 Meters Down.
Good point. I should have picked up on that. So we've got two sisters, Lisa, who's played by Mandy Moore, and Kate, who's Claire Holt, are on holiday in Mexico. Okay. So Lisa's just gone through a breakup, and it's because she thinks that her other half thought she was too boring and too safe and, you know, wouldn't kind of take risks. So she goes along with Kate and their two new local handsome male friends when they suggest going cage diving to see great white sharks off the coast in a ship owned by a slightly darn at heel Matthew Modine. I mean, I feel like if you're going to go cave diving with sharks, more power to you. You probably want to go in a really, really, really modern, well-kitted out, carefully maintained ship. Mm-hmm. This is not that ship. And so the cable breaks, the cage falls, and the two women are left 47 meters down.
And that's in feet, that's what? So it's 47.
Multiply by 3, Chris. We can wait. And
that's 141 feet.
Well,
up yours.
Oh, yeah.
Boom. Google hunting in the house.
If only he were. Anyway, basically what we have is then the two of these women, they are now at the bottom of quite a long distance underwater. It's long enough that you risk getting the bends if you go straight up. So you can't just swim for it as fast as possible. You have to stop in the middle for like 5 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And there are great white sharks around.
Ooh.
And they're running out of air.
No.
Yeah.
No, the sharks are running out of air.
No, okay, that was badly constructed on my part. I acknowledge that now.
They're running out
of air. The women at the bottom of the sea are running out of air.
This is incredible.
So it is pretty tense stuff. And that's basically it. It's really tense. You're worried about the entire time. Anytime they stick a finger or a toe or an arm or their entire bodies out of the cage, which they keep doing... I was basically screaming at the screen, no, don't stop, go back.
No.
It was very scary. But that, I mean, I am, as we know, a scaredy cat. My scaredy may not be your scaredy, but I was certainly very tense. And from the sounds in the cinema where I saw it, I was not on my own for that. It's a nice, neat, sort of 90-ish minute film. In fact, 85, under 90. Yeah. So it keeps the tension up basically the whole time. They're in the shark cage from about sort of 10, 15 minutes in, and then they're in it from then on. There are some issues, definitely. I mean, some of the lines could not be more on the nose, on the shark's nose. And
can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
How do they communicate down there?
They're in the kind of masks where you can talk. Like full face mask kind of thing. It's okay.
That would be a different movie, wouldn't it?
Yeah, super boring. Well,
for 90 minutes.
One of the best scenes, one of the best sequences in Jaws, of course, is the moment where Richard Dreyfuss goes down under the water and he's for... That's basically him.
And that works in Jaws, but I think for
85 minutes.
Yeah, it wouldn't work. I mean, this is a bit more like The Shallows probably a couple of years ago, but the sharks are not quite as focused.
When are we getting a pro-shark movie? When are we getting a movie in which the sharks are the good guys?
Do you know what? It's a good question, Chris, because it's not very fair. And, you know, shark activists always complain about Jaws. So this one, I think, is quite good because it doesn't, it's not a sort of, the sharks are not hunting them. They're just in the area because the waters have been chummed, which they shouldn't have been, and they make a point of that.
Never chum.
Don't chum the waters.
Don't chum the waters. Life hack.
I don't want to get into spoiler territory, but there is a thing at the end of this film that reminds me of another horror film, and we can discuss that once you've all seen it. But it's an interesting thing.
The Exorcist.
I'm not going to discuss
the
it,
Omen.
Chris. It's The Exorcist. It's not The Exorcist. Okay. Anyway, so we give this 3 stars. It's very effective as what it is.
Okay. Which, as we always say in the podcast, is, of course, a shark recommendation, so... Do check it out, 47 meters down. And very quickly this week, we should mention that Captain Underpants is out as well. It is an animated movie. It is not a documentary about me. It is about a superhero who runs around in tidy whities. And we gave that 2 stars. 2 stars. I'm afraid, sadly, we thought it was... Someone want to finish that sentence for me?
Poopy pants?
Or just pants?
Just pants, John.
Just pants, John.
Poop. You're always obsessed with the poop, aren't you?
That's a character name from reading that review. There's a character called Professor Poopy Pants, which, I mean, that's worth a star, isn't it?
That is worth a star in itself as well. Well, that is it. That means it's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. I won't be around. I'm going to be in France on holiday. Helen?
Is also not going to be around.
You're
I'm
not around.
Going to be on a secret mission.
Really?
Yeah.
Hang on. I think I know what this is.
Yeah.
I think. I know what this is. This is cool.
It's a cool.
That's a cool
mission.
Secret mission. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Going to a shark tank?
Never go in a shark tank.
You're going to shave Henry Cavill's tash at the end of filming for Mission Impossible
it's,
6.
It's a big ceremony. We're all going.
That's not going to be in August, is it? That's right. John, are you available next week?
I guess I have to be.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So join. John next week for more film-related fun
myself.
Be joined by Bryan Cranston. That's pretty good.
That's awesome. I've got tickets to see him in Network.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm mad as hell.
I'm not going to take it anymore.
because you paid, presumably. And who else are we joined by next week? James McAvoy, star of Atomic Blonde. And Bryan Cranston's in a film called Wakefield, which is going straight to DVD. And digital download very, very soon. So keep your eyes peeled for that one as well. Right, until that auspicious occasion, it's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from John.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to just put some toilet roll around the edges of the toilets here at the Empire building, the studios. And transform people's lives.
So wasteful.
I care about people's buttocks, Helen. Does that make me a bad person?
That doesn't make you a bad person.
It's the way in which I care about them. Is that what you're saying? All right. Thanks for listening. See you in a couple of weeks. Helen just made an obscene hand gesture, everybody.
I just gestured at all of him.
It was obscene. All of me?
Yeah.
All right. So you're saying there's a 60% chance that I'm obscene?
Sure.
Anyway, we'll work out the maths on that one. See you in a couple of weeks' time. Bye.